Now, the process of restoring and rebuilding trust in communities of color. The murder conviction came swiftly and decisively in the Derek Chauvin case. But as we've learned, murder convictions of officers for fatal police shootings are incredibly rare. And the trauma, it continues for BIPOC communities. What do you think this case will mean for the future of policing? What do you hope changes? Conversation is right here, 800-642-1234. Eddie Moore Jr. is a Wisconsin-based author, speaker, and consultant on the topics of diversity and cultural competence. He's worked with police departments and trained officers on bias and diversity. Eddie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate Archer-Kent. Good to be here. Good to hear you again.
Good morning. What emotions can you share with us have you been experiencing and working through in the week since Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering George Floyd?
Yeah, I don't want to say celebration, but I do feel a sense of joy for the family because I think just being able to know that there'll be some consequences associated with the death of a family member, I just have to feel that there was some joy there and I shared some of that. But also, I think some frustration, some anger, some still some rage for me inside, because almost simultaneously as that verdict is being read, another death is happening in the same way. Mm. And so that rage, that emotion is running through me as well. And then lastly, just as a Black man, I mean, I don't want to believe that, I mean, when I leave my house, really, is it possible that I'll never come back? Just going to the store, just, you know, traveling to a Target or a Home Depot or whatever I may be doing in my day-to-day life, is it still possible? Just day-to-day engagement in life could end in death for me as a Black man, me as a father of a Black son. So I don't want to say I feel fear, but there is some worry in my spirit that bothers me as well. Kate, so that's all the stuff I'm jumbling up inside when I, think about, the time we're in, particularly in reference to the verdict.
So many conflicting emotions there, the frustration, the anger, the rage, but also some uplifting emotion for the family. And I'm wondering, there are conversations about policy around legislation and around police training and how to stop these fatal encounters. When we focus on the policy, what are we leaving out?
I think the thing I feel is missing is just some visible engagement of police, of citizens, of community in a multicultural way. I think any difficult challenge, any difficult situation, I think the research is showing that when we have a diverse group of people involved in solving that issue, that we're more likely to get to a answer, and it's more likely to be a more impactful answer, a solution. And I feel like that's missing, at least for me visually. I'm not seeing that. I know there's sometimes individual police leaders speaking out, talking about doing some things. Of course, people in the community. But I feel like there's a real absence of the visible presence of those folks all together grappling, sitting in a room saying, over this 6 months' time or 3 months' time, months' time, we're going to get to an answer. And it feels like there's still some powerful stuff happening in silos, but I feel like we really need a collective, collaborative, intersectional approach, so to speak, that is visible for our kids, for our communities, as we grapple with this difficult issue.
So it sounds like a diverse coalition and people really working shoulder to shoulder and working on, getting this done together.
I think that's something I feel is at least visibly I'm not seeing. I'm not saying it may not be happening in some places, that I may be missing it, but I feel nationally, it feels like we hear from the police, we hear from the community, but where is that kind of unity approach?
We're talking with Eddie Moore Jr. He's an author. He founded the Privilege Institute. He works on the root causes of structural racism every day and consults on strategies for equity. You can join in 800-642-1234. Bill is joining us in Watertown. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I'm glad that this is a topic that we can all talk about, and I think that everybody wants to see unity. I think one of the issues that, you know, from the white community into the African-American community is that oftentimes we see so many of these people that have unfortunately suffered this way are typically, or we've seen a lot of sort of career criminals or criminals in the area. And the white community, I think just at large, views that as being protection for our community, that we're trying to protect that. How do we get the balance between that, where we're not elevating, say, a criminal or a career criminal above the people that are supposed to protect the communities from the career criminals?
Eddie, your insights.
Yeah, thank you for that, Bill. You know, I think what I would ask for folks as they're looking at these situations, these scenarios, in the case of as far back as Trayvon Martin to, I mean, most recently, George Floyd. Again, I'm not sure what people mean by career criminal, you know, mastermind criminal or whatever that may be. But what I would say, Bill, no one should die for a counterfeit $20 bill. That's what's bothering some for me. No matter how many times he's been engaged with the police, the fact that he's dead for an offense of counterfeit $20 bill, where, I mean, some could argue other populations of people who've committed major crimes, major deaths, I mean, somehow make it into the police office, to the police car, to the police station unharmed, unscathed. I think that's where people, myself, is feeling bothered. It feels like, not that I don't want the police involved, not that we don't want police policing the community and keeping us safe. I'm not saying that, but I think what I'm looking at, what I'm feeling is happening, is whether it's a 10th time offense or a 150th time offense, whatever, I don't think someone involved in the kind of situation that George Floyd was in with a counterfeit bill should be dead. We've seen other folks who are, again, as I said, involved in other kinds of crimes that get to the station unharmed.
I'm wondering, you recently held an event where you and a police officer shared your experiences. What do you believe the value of that kind of dialogue was, and what happened?
Yeah, well, the value of that dialogue was what I mentioned earlier, Kate, is at least some visible engagement of a Black man and a policeman telling their story. Me being able to say to Officer Kevin, here's how I'm feeling as a Black man when I think about the police. Here's what I've been taught about that. And him being able to counter that, us having a real relationship, a real conversation about some real emotions, some real experiences. And even in some cases where we agree, in some cases where we disagree, what's most important is our relationship, and being able to visibly have that on displays. I think that was what was most powerful. And for me, I think it helped to, you know, I'm not saying solve some of my bias in reference to the police. I still have it. I'm going to admit to that, and I'm working on that. But it helps when I have a real life police officer. I'm not just saying policeman. I'm saying Officer Kevin. I know him. We had a conversation. We have a relationship. And for me, I think that's what helped me. And I hope what helped the listening, viewing audience was some visible, again, ways that they can see these engagements happening.
Tony is joining us from Egg Harbor with thoughts. Tony, hi.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to have a short conversation regarding what I call culturalism, that people who may not see themselves as racists, but they're isolationists because they're uncomfortable in cultures dissimilar from themselves. So if a person's not comfortable in the culture of the Asian community, and then they isolate themselves into a culture that they grew up in, and they would flat out say they are not racists, but they're isolationists because they don't want to venture out past their culture. And I think we need to have a realistic conversation about isolationism.
And Tony, I want to jump in here because we are short on time. What are the consequences of, you know, taking that isolationism and following that path? Eddie, are you there?
Sorry, I thought you were asking Tony. I mean, again, I think, Tony, listen, if you want to be an isolationist, that's fine. I mean, I think, hey, you should have the freedom to do that. If you don't want to hang out with, be around, talk with, interact with Black folks, I mean, I'm not saying, hey, you're a racist. If you want to name that isolationist, that's cool. But if you're the police, right, and I'm part of the citizenry, you can't, in my opinion, have an isolation approach. Because you're going to really be building some inexperience, some walls, some lack of existence in proximity to me and my cultural understanding and interaction. And therefore, it could impact the way you engage me. So I think for certain professions, that isolation is dangerous. Mm. Teachers, folks interacting with the general public, their job is to serve the general public. But for individual citizens, if that's something you choose, this is America. Hey, isolate. More power to you. I don't think it's the reality of the world we're going to be living in, but we can agree to disagree on that. But I'm not going to name you racist because you decide to live in segregation or isolation. But I am saying, as a police officer, as a public servant, that shouldn't be an option.
Eddie, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Kate. Anytime.
Eddie Moore Jr. is an author, speaker, and consultant. He founded the Privilege Institute, works on strategies for equity. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.